Veteran Podcast. Thank you for your service.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Bulletproof Veteran Podcast. I'm honored this week to have on the show, we have Cole Lyle. He is the Executive Director of Mission Roll Call. And if you're a veteran, you've probably heard of this organization. They're big on Instagram. You see a lot of their posts, a lot of their information out there. They do a lot of great work advocating for veterans in the healthcare space, but also in suicide prevention, amplifying the voice of tribal and rural veterans who unfortunately maybe don't get the same voice in Washington that we would like. You know, the big cities kind of always overshadow. We know that too often. And also, they deal with specific challenges of trying to get VA care and everything like that. You know, driving 4 hours to a VA facility might not be the greatest thing for people. So, Cole, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. Thank you for having me.
So the way we usually start the show off is that we hear a little bit about the person before we jump into the organization and everything that we want to talk about. So I'd love to hear a little bit about yourself. I know you are a Marine, and I know you also worked in D.C. for some time. So please, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, I was in the Marine Corps from 2008 to 2014. I did a deployment to Afghanistan in 2011. When I got out of the Marine Corps, you know, didn't have a job, wasn't in school, was going through a nasty divorce, had some issues with post-traumatic stress, and was using VA, had been prescribed pills and therapy, wasn't really working for me. So unfortunately, I had a suicide attempt back in 2014. And that prompted me to seek alternative methods of treatment for my post-traumatic stress. So I ended up getting a service dog, a German Shepherd named Kaya. Mm-hmm. And, I came up to DC to intern on Capitol Hill. And while I was doing that, I got stopped by a senator that asked me about my dog and got into the VA's lack of funding for service dogs and other forms of holistic approaches to mental health. And so that's kind of what got me into policy and advocacy. I authored a bill called the PAWS Act, acronym for Puppies Assisting Wounded Service Members. And it didn't pass that Congress, but it was super bipartisan in 2016. Keep in mind, I was also a full-time student at Texas A&M, so I was flying back and forth from Texas to DC to advocate for this. So when I graduated, I moved to DC full-time, got a job working for the American Legion briefly, ended up working for a senator on Capitol Hill, worked at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and then got out and started getting into the nonprofit world and ended up at Mission Roll Call. After the withdrawal in Afghanistan last year, I could see kind of the writing on the wall with some of the mental health challenges that people were experiencing. And Mission Roll Call's number one priority is suicide prevention. So it, I felt like I was being led to come into this organization, and it's a good one, and I'm glad I'm here.
Yeah. And it's, I guess it's kind of fitting that here we are a year out from the fall of Afghanistan and everything that happened there. We've talked about it a lot on this show. It's unfortunate to see, and we talk about suicide, the brother of one of the service members that was lost there, one of the Marines that was lost in Afghanistan, just committed suicide. And you see how if we're not taking care of the people as we go along, if we're not being proactive in our suicide prevention, what can happen? Right. I mean, that poor family and what they've gone through, I can only imagine. So it's great that organizations like yours are out there trying to tackle this and be advocates for veterans and make sure people are getting the care that they really need well before we reach the point where we're into a suicide attempt and all of that, so that we're reaching out and we're engaging. What are some of the things that Mission Roll Call does to advocate for that?
Yeah, so we are an advocacy organization. We're a nonprofit, but our main goal is to poll veterans about issues under consideration by Congress, the VA, about issues that concern them and will have a direct effect on them. And we feed that information back to the members of Congress. We can get as granular as zip code and tell them how their veterans are feeling in their district about a policy. Or we can go as broad as national and give that information to the committees of jurisdiction that are kind of going through iterations and negotiations of different policies and bills so they can be more well-informed. But We also want that data, you know, having been a Senate staffer myself, I understand that they deal a lot in abstract numbers and, mm-hmm. and it can get kind of impersonal, right? So we want to humanize it for them. So we go all this year, we've been going around the country to high veteran population states per capita and gross, and telling the story of veteran service organizations that serve veterans on the ground, local veterans themselves, and then talk with government entities, VAs in the area. We typically do a poll of that area of veterans and how satisfied they are with the VA's outreach in their area. Mm-hmm. And so we can use that to go to VA officials and members of Congress. And if it's very positive, we can say, hey, how'd you crack the code? Why are veterans so happy with this? Or if it's negative, we can say, what are your biggest challenges and why can't you overcome them? Right. And so either way, it's a good way to have conversations because, you know, there's a common saying amongst veterans that if you've been to one VA, you've been to one VA because experiences can vary so widely
yes.
At each location. And so we find that in a lot of different areas of the country for different reasons, veterans just have completely different ideas of how well the VA is doing in their area.
Yeah.
So that's another way. We take those stories and we give them back to the policymakers in conjunction with the data mm-hmm. To kind of humanize it.
And your network is pretty vast. I mean, you're talking, I think one of the figures I saw is like 1.4 million veterans that right. are kind of like in your network that you're polling and you're trying to gather this data because our elected officials aren't going to do this for us. They're not going to sit and do the polling and figure all this information out, consolidate it, like you said, humanize it, all of this. So if we're not feeding them this data, they're not getting it, and then veterans go into the back and, you know, you're just going to get whatever they come up with that's a good hot topic kind of bill that they want to pass, and you're not going to get that stuff that we really need and what your network is telling Congress and, you know, the president and our elected officials, hey, we need this X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, and it's an important point because most of the big, what we call the big six VSOs, the American Legion, the VFW, DAV, those organizations, especially the ones that were chartered by Congress, like that was their whole point of existence, was to give Congress information and to advocate for veterans across the country. Now, what makes us different is most of those organizations, the local veteran will engage with their local post, right? Or their mm-hmm. local community group. And that post, if they have an idea about legislation or policy and they want to see a change, that kind of gets filtered at that local level. And then it gets filtered at the state convention level. And then it gets filtered at the national level before it gets to the headquarters of that organization in Washington, D.C. And every year, most of the big six have the opportunity to present their priorities for the veterans they serve to Congress. But unfortunately, the individual veteran's voice can kind of get lost in that, which is why we like to go direct to the veteran in these pollings. And for listeners, they can go to missionrollcall.org and sign up for the text and email polls themselves. But we feel it gives veterans a more direct voice on policy under consideration, rather than having representatives of organizations talk about policy that frankly may not do a lot of traveling around the country, mm-hmm. But it's like this, you know, on automatic pilot thing. So that's kind of how we're different.
Yeah. It seems like it's a more direct voice. I mean, to simplify it, because if I have an idea, if you pose a question to me and I have an idea, I want you to give my idea, whether good, bad, or indifferent, it's still my idea. I want you to give my idea at the end. But if it's something, like you said, that goes through three or four layers of filter before it reaches an elected individual that might propose a bill or a change to something or funding for something, it's not going to be my idea anymore. It's going to be a mishmash of other people's ideas and what we think we could pass and what we maybe can't pass and, you know, gone through very – very right. big filters before it gets to an actual individual that can make change.
Right. I mean, and so the perfect example of this is, you know, the PACT Act mm-hmm. was just passed, right? And earlier this year, I want to say April, May timeframe, there were two competing bills under consideration. There was a House bill that was more or less the version that eventually passed that had health care and disability benefits. But there was a Senate bill led by Senator Tester, committee chairman on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, that was healthcare only. And that was kind of obviously what had gone through a bipartisan approach in the Senate committee. And it passed the Senate. And then the House said, we're not going to consider that. We want this kind of larger effort, right? And most of the VSOs, I think all of the big six VSOs came out and said, we support the House version and we want this to pass now. So we did a poll and we said, in context, right, it's much more likely that now we ended up being wrong, so take this with a grain of salt. But we said, you know, it's much less likely that the House version passes, especially considering the Senate version was led by Senator Tester, a Democrat. Mm-hmm. This has already passed the Senate. Would you rather see healthcare only pass now or potentially wait months for a larger version to be considered and passed that includes disability benefits? And like 75% of our respondents, I think we got over 6,000 veteran responses, said that they would prefer healthcare only to pass, right? Which is not what the VSOs were advocating for. So that's a pretty good example of how we can poll. And we weren't trying to be political about it. Mm-hmm. We were just saying, let's ask the veterans themselves what they think about this, because sometimes, unfortunately, you know, I know people at a lot of these organizations, but when one organization supports something, like most of them support it, or when one organization opposes it, most of them oppose mm-hmm. it, right? There's not a whole lot of disagreement when it comes to the big six and advocating on Capitol Hill. So that was just one small example of how, you know, we can interject the veteran voice and make sure that the voice of veterans is being heard.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times people assume the voice of veterans. So one of the things that I know made some of the news, it wasn't that, you know, talked about, but it was something that I saw and talked to a few friends about. It was the amendment to the PACT Act the last week, actually the day it was going to for the final vote before it was passed. There was an amendment by, I believe, Blackburn. She wanted to add community care to it. Now, speaking for your rural and tribal side, that to me would be, I would think, without being polled and having a very good VA close by my house here in Northport in New York, who, you know, I have to say the VA here is actually very good and very close by for me, I would think that most veterans would want that community care. Now, I don't know. I haven't done any polling. I have no data to substantiate that, but I would think that that would be the case.
Well, we have.
I know. Yeah. And that's why I bring it up, because I'm interested to see what your data says, because it was very quick on the House floor to say, no, veterans don't want that. They want to go to a VA.
This is such a complicated argument. And this is the next debate, the next major debate mm-hmm. that's going to occur. This is complicated for a couple of different reasons, because the polling that we have done about veterans, and I can get into specifics, but you know, people, if they're interested, could go to missionrollcall.org and we have an archived list of polls that we've done, so they can check out the polls on community care. But
that's awesome.
Essentially, I actually wrote an op-ed that got published last week in the Washington Examiner, and in the op-ed I stated, the veteran argument about community care basically boils down to this, right? They prefer to get their care at the VA, but if the VA can't provide it within a certain reasonable time or distance, they don't care who provides it mm-hmm. as long as they don't have to pay for it.
Yes.
Right? That is essentially what the entire argument for community care can boil down to. Because yes, the VA does some things better. I personally use the VA for 100% of my healthcare. I don't have private health insurance. Mm-hmm. And I've had mostly positive experiences with the VA, with the notable exception of my early experiences. And then recently I tried to schedule a specialty psychology appointment, psychology appointment. And they gave me something like 3 months out. So I said, okay, let me use community care. And then it mm-hmm. became this whole thing. But community care, obviously this whole thing started in 2014 when the Phoenix waitlist scandal happened. Yes. And Congress said, you know, this is an egregious failure of the VA, you know, to accomplish their mission, which is to care for veterans. So they created this, what I call a relief valve, which is if the VA can't provide that care that's in the reasonable time and distance, they're supposed to refer veterans out for care by a private healthcare provider. That had some issues with funding. So it went through another iteration called the Mission Act, which passed in 2018, mm-hmm. which consolidated funding streams on the back end and provided access standards, 6 access standards that the VA should adhere to. And they include the reasonable time and distance and a couple of other things. But it's become so successful since the Mission Act has passed. Every year, authorizations for community care has gone up. And the VA now says that community care accounts for 1/3 of all of their healthcare spending. So they've testified on the Hill and said, we're concerned about this trend because it means that it could fracture healthcare for veterans and also degrade existing VA facilities. They're worried about the facilities, you know, not getting the appropriate funding they need based on more veterans using care in the community. They're not asking themselves the fundamental problem with that. And for the record, they're talking about changing the access standards mm-hmm. so that less veterans can go out in the community. The fundamental problem with that is they're not asking themselves why. They're not asking themselves, why do veterans right. either prefer care in the community mm-hmm. or why are these access standards? Why can't we provide veterans care within this amount of time? Mm-hmm. So rather than ask themselves those questions seriously and give Congress some proposed legislation to fix the underlying challenges for why community care is expanding, they're just saying, we're going to turn off that relief valve. We're going to make it a little bit harder for veterans to use care in the community, which frankly, I think will get us back to eventually a Phoenix VA
situation
type thing where veterans. So it's as somebody that uses the VA personally, that has worked at the VA, mm-hmm. that has worked on Capitol Hill, you know, my op-ed essentially said, Congress needs to stop VA from fixing what is not broken. This program is working. Veterans are using it. And I don't care if a veteran gets their care at the VA or in the private sector. Some of the polling we have done has said that veterans don't care. They just want veterans to get, especially in mental health, the care that they need in a timely manner. Because mm-hmm. especially with mental health, it can be very time sensitive.
Of course.
So anyways, that's going to be the next huge debate over the next couple months.
Yeah. And it seems almost like the classic joke. If you're a government employee, I know you've heard the saying, fix it till it's broke. And that almost sounds exactly like what they're doing. They're trying to fix something and breaking it in the process. And let's just keep fixing it. And then in the end result will be, like you said, it'll be pre-Phoenix. We'll be back to long lines, long wait times, people not getting the care, misdiagnosed because people are overworked, all that kind of stuff. Because as quickly as I've said this many times on the show, as quickly as I will call out the VA for failures that I've seen, I'm also a realist in the fact that they aren't funded properly for a lot of things. And you can stop me at any time, please, because you've worked there, so you know.
Yeah,
this.
I mean,
I don't know how what your feeling is.
I don't think it, I honestly could say, and I think most people would agree, like, I don't think it's a funding problem.
Okay.
You know, the VA's budget went up from, I think it was $45 billion roughly in 2001. Their last budget request was $301 billion. Now, most of that is what's called mandatory spending, mm-hmm. which is spending that the VA, like, they have no control over. They yes. can't ask Congress. It's on autopilot is what mandatory spending is. And that is the disability compensation that they pay out to veterans for mm-hmm. disabilities that they have as a result of their service. So most of it is mandatory spending. But the discretionary side has even blown up exponentially. For a lot of different reasons, because, you know, obviously we were in conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan mm-hmm. and other areas for 20 plus years. There is a the VA says that some inflationary healthcare costs are going into why they need more money for, which I, you know, I take their point. And, but community care, they say it tends to be more expensive than in-house VA care, infrastructure concerns. So they need more money to fix facilities because most of these facilities were built in the 50s or 60s.
Yes. Yep.
There's a lot that goes into that, but I don't necessarily think it's a funding problem because Congress has essentially rubber stamped every VA budget request for the last 20 plus years or so. I think it's more of an efficiency problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the VA is the nation's largest healthcare system,
yes,
like in the country.
Yes.
They have thousands of facilities everywhere. Their full-time employees have gone from roughly 220,000 in 2003 to 447,000 in 2019, 2020. Don't mm-hmm. quote me on the exact date, but it's more than doubled in the 20 years. Meanwhile, you know, there's 18.2 million veterans in the United States. Only about 50% of them are even enrolled in VA healthcare. And of the 9 million roughly that are enrolled in VA healthcare, the VA only regularly sees about 3.5 million of those. So the growth of the VA's budget and the growth of the amount of full-time staff they have is not equivalent. It has risen at faster rates than the amount of veterans that use VA for healthcare and are enrolled in healthcare. So that's why I don't necessarily think it's a funding problem. I think it's more the fact that it's a large healthcare system that is controlled from a central location in DC. You have what are called integrated service networks, VISNs, that are basically like the Southeast United States, mm-hmm. the Northwest United States, whatever. VISN directors and local facilities have an enormous amount of flexibility on how they utilize budgets and programs based on the needs of veterans in their district, because veterans in New York are going to be served differently than veterans in rural Montana, right? So that makes sense. But unfortunately, it makes it hard to coordinate and implement legislation that passes in a uniformly positive way.
Hmm.
And so that's why it's such a complicated agency, you know, and sometimes VSOs and Congress pass things, but they don't give, I will admit, some things they don't necessarily give the VA enough funding for or enough time to implement before they come back and say, why isn't this working faster? And then they pass more legislation to try to help them, you know, implement this faster. But then the VA has to go through a whole other implementation process. So it's a hugely complicated agency and organization. Anyways, that was a long answer to your
question. And I appreciate the answer because it almost seems like, and I use the terminology loosely, but it's almost destined to kind of fail in a way. You know, not that it's failing, but it's destined to not meet expectations because of everything you just listed, because of bloat, because of bureaucracy, you know, because of changing in legislation, changing in needs, all the different things that are going on. How would it work? You know what I mean? Like, I almost want to say it like that. Like, you expect this to meet everyone's healthcare needs? You know what I mean? With all this other stuff going on, it would be almost ludicrous to think that would happen.
And that's not even mentioning or getting into the politics of it, right?
Of course.
Because that's just policy.
Right.
We haven't even talked about politics. There's a group of people, and frankly, I've been accused, and my organization has been accused, which is ludicrous, but that have accused, there's a group of people that say, you know, there are certain advocates out there that want privatization. They don't want the VA to exist, and mm-hmm. they want veterans to use private healthcare. It's kind of a boogeyman argument. And because of the growth that I was talking about and funding and full-time staff, and I mean, even though the veterans haven't, the rate hasn't gone up at the same rate, but like more veterans still are enrolled in VA healthcare. The VA is not going anywhere. So even if people wanted to do that, it's never going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
But yeah, it's not going to happen. But it's kind of a boogeyman argument because, again, I use the VA for my healthcare. I like the care I get mm-hmm. at the VA for the most part, with some exceptions. But they do some things very, very well.
Of course.
Because they cater to a group of people that have unique experiences, mm-hmm. And needs in their healthcare and their benefits. And nobody wants to see that go away. Nobody. No reasonable person in policy wants to see that go away. We just want veterans to get taken care of in whatever method is required to do that as fast as possible. And in some cases, when the VA can't provide that care, community providers can do it better or faster. Mm-hmm. So there's a group of people there that are pushing this false narrative of, you know, we want privatization, or people want privatization of the VA. But on the other hand, you know, there are people that do say, you know, community care, the reason this is so successful is because the private healthcare system is more efficient. And I know some people are going to laugh at that because I've dealt with the private healthcare system, but
I've been down many roads.
It's not right. So that's kind of the political back end of what's going on here. And, you know, the Air Commission, which is another thing that was passed in the Mission Act, AIR is the Asset Infrastructure Review. So for people who are unfamiliar, it's kind of like a BRAC, a DOD BRAC, where they look at facilities and they recommend closures mm-hmm. to some, and it's all based on a market assessment. And because stop me if I'm rambling or whatever.
No,
I'm
please.
Just thinking of this as I go. So there are some tectonic shifts going on in the veteran community right now. One being that the veteran population is rapidly declining because the Vietnam era of veterans, unfortunately, are getting to the point where, you know, they're passing away at a, mm-hmm. at a higher rate. There were less service members that served in Iraq and Afghanistan that are coming back. So the younger demographic, there's just not as many veterans, right? So mm-hmm. there's a rapidly declining population. A lot of veterans are moving from traditionally high population states like New York, California, to the South, to Texas, Florida, different locations like that. And then you have these healthcare facilities that are from the 50s and 60s. So Congress passed the Air Commission with the Mission Act in 2018 that required the VA to come back and Congress to create this group of commissioners to go back to the VA or to Congress and say, we recommend these closures and whatever. But a lot of members oppose this, Republicans and Democrats, because they're worried about facilities being closed in their district and the jobs that come with them. Mm-hmm. And it becomes complicated. And so the Air Commission was just shut down by a bipartisan group of senators that said, you know, because of COVID and because of different demographic issues, we're not the data that we're going to get from the commission won't be current and won't be relevant. So we need to come back and take another bite at this apple. But again, on the back end of that, there are some people that have said that maybe the reason that they didn't want the VA to come out with the commission to come out with these recommendations is because it would have happened in an election year, right? There are some people that have said that the Air Commission was really meant to be this privatization effort for mm-hmm. VA to close facilities and force more veterans into communities. When in reality, you know, it's about having a realistic market assessment of how many veterans in each community does the VA need to serve? And are these facilities way too big or are they not big enough, right? Mm-hmm. Are there some rural areas that veterans have been moving to that need expanded facilities? So it's a hugely complicated agency from a policy perspective, but also from a political perspective. But unfortunately, because most of the American public doesn't really have a frame of reference when they're talking about veterans issues, because, you know, 80% of veterans have said that they have an immediate family member that served, meaning that military service is kind of becoming a family business.
Yep.
The American people get what they know about veterans from Hollywood. So it makes it harder for the public in general to put pressure on Congress, unless there's like a crisis, like the Phoenix waitlist thing. Because they don't pay attention to these policy issues as much as they do to, you know, the DOD going to war and name your country, or healthcare that affects them on a day-to-day basis, or taxes or something mm-hmm. like that. It's just not something that they have as much they have as many touch points that affects their lives personally, because the American public by and large just doesn't, you know, the average person doesn't know that many veterans.
Right. Right. And there's also the level of, it, like going back to your point about the political side of things, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or whatever the case may be, if you're not in touch with veterans, if you're just a regular civilian, you don't know anybody who serves, you might just want to hear that they're giving money to the VA. And you're happy. And it doesn't matter if it's good, bad, or indifferent. You hear that they're doing the PACT Act, and that's they're giving money to veterans, so that's a good thing.
Right.
My senator from my party or my congressperson from my party voted yes on it. It's a talking point that they can throw out. They're going to get reelected because of it. And that's all I really care about, because the veterans are getting taken care of. Now, are they really? Is what getting passed really what veterans need? And I think that's where Mission Roll Call comes in to – gather this data and feed it to a good place where we're actually finding out, yeah, are veteran needs really being met?
Yeah. And this, to be honest, was what was so disappointing to me about what I saw as the response to, you know, the PACT Act, the delay, the cloture vote, mm-hmm, that Senator Toomey blocked and everything, because immediately most of the VSOs came out. And they're all smart enough to know, like, it's not the death knell of the,
right,
of the effort. It's a cloture vote. It might delay it, you know, for one day, 2 days. It might delay it for a week, but it's not the end of the effort. But they all came out and said, this is unacceptable. And these veterans, I mean, Twitter went nuts.
Yes,
I saw so many people being like, these Republicans hate veterans and want veterans to die. And, you know, they'll fund war, but they won't fund veterans. And like all this stuff. And, the VSOs know better than that. But unfortunately, because of what you just mentioned about the American public and not having these frames of reference, mm-hmm, if the big six VSOs come out and they kind of echo that, and I saw a lot of people that work for those VSOs saying kind of similar stuff, then the American public, you know, and then they get voices on national media outlets, the American public says, oh, well, I guess Republicans are, or Democrats or whoever it is at the time, are voting against veterans' healthcare, but they don't have a depth of understanding of these issues to be able to say, yeah, that sounds not exactly accurate, mm-hmm, or, you know, or to kind of think critically about these issues, which is why I think it's so important for VSOs to be honest about what's going on. Now, granted, I fully support disability benefits and healthcare for the PACT Act. I think the passage ultimately is a good thing. My concern is that the VA doesn't have, they're going to get a lot of claims for these health issues, some of which are a little more common, mm-hmm, than others. And I just worry with the VA already having a claims backlog of adding potentially 3.5 million more, and then the VA taking a year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe longer to approve some of these claims, and for veterans to have to go through that process, especially considering even in the PACT Act, which was the version that most VSOs wanted, it called for a phased approach into some of these health issues. So like three or four of them, you know, immediate benefits, and all of them get healthcare, but like immediate benefits.
Phase, like 2025, you could claim this. 2026, you could claim
Right.
Yeah.
And then President Biden came out after, you know, he signed it and said, like, I'm directing the VA to make it all available now, not phased approach, which was what was in the law. So that was the concern that a lot of people had before it passed, was not necessarily, you know, we don't want this to pass. We, mm-hmm, don't want veterans to have this healthcare. Everybody, I think there was very strong bipartisan support for getting veterans the healthcare and disability benefits they earned and deserved, but they had concerns about the VA's ability to implement it under, you know, the circumstances of a claims backlog and a veterans appeals, the Veterans Board of Appeals. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
A backlog. They've done a lot of work to reduce that backlog, but there's still a backlog. So adding 3.5 million more immediately would just kind of hamper their ability to continue the work they've been doing to try to reduce that backlog number. So we'll see what happens. Yeah.
I know the website the other day, when right after he signed and it went into law, for like 4 or 5 days just to check your claims, it wasn't pulling up claim status. Now, whether that was because of that or not, but you could definitely see how that could happen. You know, a bunch of people rushing a website, we all know what happens. The same thing with the burn pit registry. I had heard a lot of stories about the burn pit registry was not working for days because I think people were just rushing to go onto the burn pit registry because it was in the news and it was something to, you know, that was talked about. Hey, yeah, I was in Afghanistan, X, Y, and Z, and I was at a base, and yeah, I was the burn pit guy. We burn paper all the time or whatever, you know, whatever the case may be. You have to have a system when you add 3.8 million claims into a system that's already kind of backlogged and already has issues. I mean, I'm waiting just under a year for my claims right now. I'm just under a year. And I just set it and forget it. Like, you know, I know it's there. You know, whatever will get approved. I'll appeal whatever doesn't. I'm lucky because I don't need the money right now. And I'm getting health care.
And you'll get my back pay. So you'll get a fat check.
I'll get a great check. It's like a savings account.
Because you're on the record as saying I applied for this time and yeah, I get it. But to your point, there are some older veterans that maybe don't have that time to wait or don't have that money, that are living on Social Security or anything like that. So it it's a huge concern. And I pray that we don't have any issues that come out with this. I actually spoke to somebody pretty senior at the Board of Veterans Appeals about 2 weeks ago when this all was going down, and I raised this concern and I said, well, what do you think? Like, are y'all prepared? And their response was, we are prepared under the phased approach. And so I pray that this goes smoothly if they roll out everything at once, as President Biden said, he wanted to direct the VA to do. I worry that something is going to happen. These claims backlogs are going to get a lot worse. And then Congress is going to drag the Secretary of the VA or the head of the VBA and take them to task for saying, well, you guys aren't doing and implementing what Congress did in an appropriate time frame, and VA becomes this punching bag.
Yeah, right.
And then Congress says, well, we're going to do this and we're going to tweak this here. And then, like I said earlier, they just have to go through the whole implementation process again. So,
yeah. So another question that I have for you, and I'd love to get your insight on this, is that you talked about community care as being this thing that's probably going to come to a head shortly. You know, it's going to be kind of the next big thing. But through your polling and through what you see in Washington, what are some of the other big things that we think we're going to see? I know there's a lot of bills sitting in Congress right now. Some of them will never see the light of day. Others will. That's the way Washington works. But what are some of the big ones that we might see directly impacting veterans, whether it's suicide, healthcare, funding for different programs and things like that?
That's a good question. I think a version of a bill called the GAPS Act, which is, I think it's an acronym for Guaranteeing Healthcare Access. I forget what the P stands for, but that has direct effect on community care. And I think with the VA coming out and saying, we're thinking about, changing the access standards, the GAPS Act is a bill that would basically make those 6 access standards permanent, and the VA couldn't change them. So I think that's going to be one that'll come up. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and Congress passed in 2020 the Commander John Scott Hannon Act, which was a very large bill by Congress to try to improve the VA's approach to mental health. I don't know that for the rest of this year we're going to see any large pieces of veterans legislation because it's a midterm election year. I think we only have 3 weeks left that the Senate is going to be in session before elections. And then historically, Congress doesn't do a lot after November during the holiday period, unless there's some sort of fiscal cliff or funding emergency that needs to happen. And that's kind of what they're focused
ceiling,
on.
That type of stuff maybe gets.
Right. I would love to see, again, our number one priority, Mission Roll Call's number one priority is suicide prevention. And I think that the VA gets this issue fundamentally wrong. They look at suicide prevention from, or suicide in general, from a mental health viewpoint, through a mental health lens. And it's very reactionary. Mm-hmm. They say, if you're struggling, call 988 for the Veteran Crisis Line. Enroll with VA, see a mental health care provider, work through these issues. But like we were talking about earlier, you want to reach them before they even get to that point. Yeah. You want to make sure that they're taken care of. And frankly, suicide can be caused, though you are at a higher predisposition to take your life if you have mental health challenges, at the moment of decision, it can be not related to that at all. It can be acute financial stress that you're going through. It can be relationship stress, like a divorce or a breakup or something like that. Or maybe a parent died and there's some, whatever the case may be, it could be a conglomeration of all those things. So until the VA starts to look at it from that perspective and be more proactive in their approach, I think not only are we going to see, I don't think that we're going to see a significant reduction in suicides in the veteran community until that happens. And unfortunately, I think the official number of veterans that are taking their lives every day that the VA comes out with is tragically very conservative.
Yeah.
Because the way the VA collects this data, they get it from the CDC and the NIH, that get it from the states themselves. Not every state uniformly codes suicides, codes deaths as suicides from overdoses, for instance, or any number of different reasons. So I
car
think the
accidents
number is
another
low
one number. That I've heard is in that overdoses is in
right.
that. There's quite a few that if the coroner doesn't write it on the death certificate as such, it does not get into that. It's not part of the 22 a day that you hear so much about. And listen, there's a lot of organizations that have grappled onto that 22 and they use it for good. But it's probably not 22. It's probably a lot higher.
Well, the official number is 17 from the VA. It down from 22 and
that
was 20
right.
and now 17. But again, it goes back to kind of the data skewing it, because the VA used to collect data from 2005 to 2018, when it was, I forget if it was the 22 or the 20 a day, that's when they were collecting the data.
Mm-hmm.
They expanded the years that they were collecting data from 2005 to 18 to 2001 to 18. Now, obviously, Iraq hadn't even happened at that point, and we had just invaded Afghanistan. So the mental health challenges that resulted from deployments probably hadn't manifested for several years, right? So maybe the rate was lower during those periods. And now that they're collecting more death data, maybe that skews the data, right?
It's a way of getting that average down at that point.
Right. And I'm not trying to accuse the VA of doing that. I think they have the best intention when they collect this data. But, data can lie to you based on how it's presented, how it's collected. And people can use it for their own purposes. My point is entirely, I think the number is higher than that based on what we've been talking about. And because the VA doesn't touch 50% of the veterans in the United States, 301 billion budget requests that we were talking about, 0.1% of that $301 billion, so roughly $475 million goes to suicide prevention outreach. And the majority of that is the Veteran Crisis Line, is funding the Veteran Crisis Line, and a program called the Fox Grant Program, which was passed under the John Scott Hannon Act that I mentioned that passed in 2020. That's about $174 million. And that is money that goes directly to communities across the country that are working with veterans and doing outreach and suicide prevention. I think that's the right approach. And I think the VA needs to expand that a little more. Of course, you're going to have people come out and say, well, you're just trying to privatize, you know, the VA and fund other organizations, which is not the case at all. But the reality is that a lot of veterans don't even want to use the VA, and because of the negative perceptions and stereotypes they have of it.
Yeah.
And so how are you going to touch those veterans that may be struggling, but don't want to use you, or, you know, they like working with Team Red, White, and Blue, or they like working with Team Rubicon, or they like working with their local Student Veterans of America or, you know, organization. And that's how they get their therapy and their outreach. So I think funding organizations, you know, America's Warrior Partnership, people like that, that have networks across the country, that do good work in care coordination, which the VA can't reimburse for because, they don't reimburse for care coordination. I think that's the right approach. And until we get to a point where they fund that a little bit more and they stop looking at suicide as primarily a mental health problem, I don't see a lot of improvement, but that's why Mission Roll Call is advocating on Capitol Hill for a lot of this stuff.
Do you guys increase access? Yeah. Do you guys get involved with any of the alternative therapies? I know there's been some great work done with MDMA assisted psychotherapy. There's obviously a lot of cannabis organizations that are advocating for that to be part of you know, a VA plan and be, you know, accepted by the VA, which, you know, has had its hiccups and bumps in the road. You know, psilocybin is another one. There's a lot that's been there that isn't really being embraced by the VA. Do you guys find that through your polling and stuff like that, that that's something that we need to really be focusing on?
Well, we haven't gone specifically into like MDMA or cannabis or things like that. We have asked, you know, should the VA embrace more holistic approaches to mental health,
right?
Or to suicide prevention. And overwhelmingly, veterans, like every time we ask questions like that, it's like 90% say yes. I don't think I have a lot of friends that used to be alcoholics as a result of their issues with post-traumatic. I shouldn't say a lot, but I know several. And they stopped drinking because they use cannabis. And that's anecdotal. And obviously, you know, I'm not a researcher. But at the very least, I think that the VA should, or the, excuse me, the federal government should, Congress should deschedule, marijuana, cannabis, so that at least we can study it.
Right.
And we can maybe have some evidence, to back this up, to support anecdotal evidence from people that say it worked. MDMA, kind of same thing. I think the University of Texas is doing a study right now on MDMA.
Yeah, MAPS is doing a lot of work.
Works for them. Mm-hmm. Right. A lot of people say it worked for them. Mm-hmm. The tricky part of this is you do want some evidence, some data to back up the efficacy of this stuff, right? Especially when it comes to kind of, you know, drugs and things like that, that people use, and can abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think in a lot of cases where this holistic, these holistic approaches come up, the VA uses the lack of data, quote unquote, to delay and deter these things from being more widely available. And case in point was when I was advocating for expanded use of service dogs,
yes,
for mental health issues. They came back and they said, oh, there's not enough data to support this. And again, this is going to sound a little tinfoil hatty, but I think it's true. The people that typically run the Veterans Health Administration are themselves clinicians. Some of them are veterans, some of them aren't. But they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and years of their lives learning these traditional approaches to mental health and to suicide prevention.
They have skin in the game to keep it that way.
Right. And even though the VA's own website will go, and you can say that, you know, prolonged exposure and other psychological approaches to mental health have success rates hovering around 50%. And pharmacology, you know, they say there are quote unquote response rates, whatever that means, of 60%, but only a complete remission of symptoms of 30%, but they don't even, you know, that doesn't even take into account all the negative side effects that come with pills.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the data suggests that the traditional methods of treatment don't work as well as they, you know, maybe not should work, but
maybe are advertised.
Right. You know, even though that's public knowledge, they're reticent to say that what they've learned and what they've spent years of their lives doing, they're reticent to say that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't necessarily want to embrace these other approaches to this without data, but it's not like there's a huge sense of urgency when it comes to getting the data because they already have a preconceived bias about some of this stuff because of what they went to school for. And I think that is what frustrates me in my years of advocacy more than anything else. And I hate to say this, but I get really dejected about it
mm-hmm.
because I deal with veterans on a daily basis. After Afghanistan last year, I had three of my friends call me, just suicidal. One had a gun to his head. One was in a car driving drunk. And I had to talk him down. So I see this, I live it. I went through it myself and it frustrates me that there's not more of a sense of urgency. You just had all the VSOs, John Stewart, Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill, Senator Moran, Senator Tester did great work, saying we need this now. Veterans are dying. You know, if we don't get these people the healthcare and benefits they deserve, veterans are dying. This needs to pass now. I rarely see that sense of urgency when it comes to suicide and that passion when it comes to suicide from people on Capitol Hill. Because I feel like at this point it's become kind of a tired policy discussion that people say, well, you know, the VA, you know, and I hate to sound so like cynical about it, because I do think that individuals in the community at these organizations that are doing great work are doing great work and they should continue to do that great work. I think that at the end of the day, I get frustrated by the lack of urgency when it comes to suicide, because as I mentioned, I mean, even 17 a day, if that number is accurate, is too much.
Of course.
Right? I think it's a low figure. But why is there not more of a sense of urgency when it comes to this stuff? It baffles me, really. And I think they
like to sweep it under the carpet a little bit as well. And then again, this is just my personal opinion completely, because you have, you know, the DOD coming out and saying the number one challenge for the military is coronavirus as far as healthcare.
Or extremism.
Or extremism.
Right.
No, you're losing 17 veterans a day, again, using the low ball. Go lowball and say 17 a day. You've lost over 30,000 since the global war of terror. You know what I mean? You can't. It's not even in the same realm. The numbers don't lie as far as that's concerned. And like you said, you can skew evidence and you can have confirmation bias when you do research and all that kind of stuff. But suicide numbers don't lie in this regard. And I think a lot of times people just don't want to talk about it. They put it out in the back, or they don't have a solution. So we're going to tackle this stuff because we're going to go after the low hanging fruit because this is a harder issue to deal with.
Yeah. And to be fair, I mean, as we've said, suicide is not a univariable issue,
right?
People could spiral and get to that point for any number of reasons. I don't think it's fair to say that efforts in other areas cannot have a positive impact on this,
of course,
education, employment,
mm-hmm.
Obviously healthcare benefits, that sort of stuff. Because I think it is a holistic approach, which is what those community organizations can sometimes provide that federal resources can't.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I think another thing at play here is, and again, I know a lot of people that work on Capitol Hill. I respect their work on issues. But the reality is, like, less than 1% of congressional staff have any military experience whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
right? And most of those are concentrated in the committees of jurisdiction, like the Armed Services Committee or the VA committees. And of the veterans that work on those committees, you know, I was a junior enlisted Marine. I got out as a corporal. When I was on Capitol Hill, I could count on one hand the amount of former enlisted. And yep. not officer mm-hmm. People that worked on Capitol Hill. And that's not to say that officers don't have the same sense of urgency or care about it, but the perspective is different.
Right.
And I think the perspective of people on the enlisted side is a little underrepresented in policymaking, and frankly, the military is a little underrepresented in policymaking roles on Capitol Hill. There's a great organization called Hill Vets that is my buddy Justin Brown founded that is designed to get veterans like fellowships on Capitol Hill.
Interesting.
With the ultimate goal of getting them jobs on Capitol Hill, not necessarily in veteran related policy, but just anywhere. Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's an important perspective that I think is being missed. And, you know, if you take a step back and you look at this from a larger perspective, because there are so few people that serve on the military in any given year, veterans, like I said, the military service is becoming a family business. If veterans don't feel like they're being empowered to succeed when they get out of the military, if mothers and fathers don't think that their son or daughter is going to be taken care of while they're on active duty and empowered post-service to be successful, they're going to stop supporting their kids joining the military. And we're already seeing a recruiting crisis with the Navy, with the Army. I read something the other day that the Navy's dishing out $100,000 signing bonuses because they're having a problem recruiting people. The Army, $50,000. And that eventually, you know, if something were to happen in Taiwan when, you know, Speaker Pelosi visited a few weeks ago, or, you know, something happens somewhere else in the world, there's a very real possibility that our lack of ability to recruit will have national security implications. And you can tie that directly to how these men and women are being treated when they get out of the military and join the civilian world and transition back.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly, because I've had people approach me because of my health issues and how it's been related to the military. I've had people say, would you let your daughter join the military? And my answer is yes. And when I say let, I should use the word encourage more, because she's going to do whatever the hell she wants. But, you know, I would encourage her to. And they look at me and they're like, well, how could you do that, knowing what happened with you? And, you know, and I'm like, well, because it's just the way I feel. It's I don't blame the military. I joined. I went. And I have health issues because I have health issues. That's just the way it is. And I deal with that. But I still wouldn't trade my military service for anything. If my daughter wants to have that experience and join what I think is a brother and sisterhood that's bigger than anything, I'm going to encourage her and I'm going to support her to do that. But the problem is, I don't think a lot of people feel the same way. And I think a lot of people, like you said, they see how people are cared about when they get back, and they're like, no, I wouldn't have my kid go do that.
Yeah. Well, let's be clear, like joining the military, especially if you're from a disadvantaged background, would be a huge benefit
in terms of
like you don't have educational expenses mm-hmm. now. You can get a low interest home loan
or a lot of times you're learning a trade or a skill that you would not normally.
Learning a skill. Mm-hmm. You have now a network of people mm-hmm. that you can rely on, depend on for support, things like that. But this is you know, something that, again, because of the lack of perspective on Capitol Hill mm-hmm. and in the country more broadly, you know, when things like student loan forgiveness come up, right? I got reamed over the coals, even though people I know at Student Veterans of America and Veterans Education Success that I know agree with me in private. I went out and said publicly that, like, the veteran perspective here and the active duty perspective is not being considered in this debate, because if you just go out and forgive people's student loans after a lot of people joined to
not
get
have those loans,
GI Bill, mm-hmm. so they wouldn't have those loans, you are fundamentally degrading that mm-hmm. incentive structure and you're just going to make it harder to recruit people. And I mean, I tell you what, Twitter just went nuts on me.
well, Twitter has Twitter does that.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, it was fun to watch, but these are things that don't necessarily get considered, and because most people don't keep in touch with these issues, and they frankly take for granted the life that they are able to live in the most prosperous country in the history of the world, because our diplomats, our economic power is undergirded fundamentally by the military, and we're an all volunteer force. So if you don't sustain that all volunteer force, and we're already kind of struggling to do that, what happens?
Yeah. The downstream effects are crazy when you start thinking about worldwide and how everything works. If you don't have that power, or at least demonstrate that power on the world stage, even if it's just a show that you can recruit and you do have a military that's up to snuff and is exercising and things like that. Because our military right now is very different than the military that I was in. I got out in 05. You know what I mean? It's a completely different world. We're dealing with different challenges. Everything, the kids that are in now, or the young men and women that are in now, they weren't deploying to Iraq in, 03 and 04, or the surge in 07, 08. You know what I mean? Those people are out of the military now. Those leaders are gone. So our combat readiness changes, our combat experience changes from as this all goes on. Even though we've been at war for 20 years, it was a very strange war for 20 years, and all of that kind of plays into exactly what you're saying and how it can really impact the way the United States is seen around the world.
Yeah, I agree. And, the fight continues.
Of course.
I don't want to end being so cynical. I think there's certainly a lot of work to do for a lot of different reasons, but I think that's why, even when I can get frustrated sometimes, I think that's why I wake up and I really enjoy the opportunity that I have to lead this organization and do the things that I'm doing, because I think it's super important work. It's personally fulfilling for me. But it also, it really warms my heart whenever veterans reach out to me and they say, "Hey man, we really appreciate what you're doing." And they say, "Hey, can you tell my member of Congress XYZ, like, really appreciate his work or her work or whatever, and their support for this or that." It's great. I do encourage people, veteran or not, to get involved. People always ask me, how can I help? If the situation is as bad as you're saying it is, obviously what's the solution? How can I help? And my response is always, just get involved in a local veteran organization. You don't have to be a veteran. Or if you're in an organization that doesn't serve veterans, but could, and do a little more outreach there, do that. Get to know a veteran. If you don't have one in your family or your friend group, that's the best way to do it. Just go volunteer at a veteran organization. It doesn't have to be a lot of time. I know people are busy. They've got jobs, they've got families, but a couple hours a week, a couple hours a month, just get to know somebody and figure out the issues that they have to deal with. And then frankly, talk to your member of Congress about it, right? And don't just be surface level. Be like, "Hey, my friend is having this issue. Like, what are you doing to fix it?" Right? During political campaigns, we're a 501c3. We don't get involved in politics, but I would love for more news organizations or more town halls and questions to be focused on veterans. I loved it when President Biden mentioned veterans in the State of the Union more prominently this year than presidents have done for years.
Yeah.
It was great, because I just don't think we see a lot of that attention and that focus, in campaigns and in policy. And I think your average civilian could have an effect on that.
100%. I really do agree. Well, like you said, I always like, leaving on a high note in a good way. And I think that's a great way to end it. But I want to make sure people know where they can get more information about Mission Roll Call, what you guys are doing, all of that. And again, how maybe they can get some ideas about how to get involved in all of that. So tell us a little bit where people can go.
Yeah. So the easiest way, go to missionrollcall.org. And you can, there's multiple opportunities there. Top right, there's a red button. You can sign up if you're a veteran. If you're not a veteran, you can still sign up, but there's a tab that you can stipulate that you're a veteran and what service and what era you served in, so that we can pull you directly on issues like we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You can sign up for our newsletter to keep up with what we're doing, where we're traveling, who we're talking to. Follow us on social media. We're on every platform, I think, except TikTok. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, follow us on there. And you know, if you are a veteran that is struggling, we have some resources on there. You can sign up for, our partner organizations network, which provides referrals for community organizations across the country. So yeah, that's the best place to start.
Well, excellent. I hope everybody takes advantage of that. Just to be a part of the polls is, I think, a very important thing. Have your voice heard. If you like complaining like I do, don't just complain. Complain and make sure you're doing something about it. There's a responsibility that we all kind of have. So if you're an old curmudgeon like me, you know, it's a great way. It's an outlet and you can get polled about these different things. So I encourage everybody to get over there and do that. Cool. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. It's been a blast having you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
All right. So you have a great rest of the day, all right? I want to thank Cole for coming on the show. That was just a blast and a lot of information. So if you are ever interested in how some of this works and behind the scenes and advocacy and all of that, I mean, that was a great glimpse into it. I mean, that's a lot of knowledge for somebody that's actually worked in the Capitol, has worked for the VA, and now works in veteran advocacy. I mean, it's such a different perspective than, you know, just hearing stories or looking at the news or something like that. So that was really cool to be able to have Cole on the show and kind of go through that. We switched things up a little bit for this episode, and we went right into the interview. It's a new format that I'm trying out, and I hope you guys liked it, where you don't have to listen to me drone on at the beginning of the show. Get right into the interview, get you guys the information you want, and then do all my splurge at the end. You know, we'll see. We'll see if you guys like it. If you don't, I could always switch back, but it was something I wanted to try, kind of hook in new listeners with right into the interview. And write to the people that you want to hear talking rather than my dumbass. But I still do have some information for you here at the end. The Run for Briggs was a great event. They had some amazing pictures from out there. I had to work, so I wasn't able to go out there. I did the virtual, which is such an awesome option for all these races. So if you feel like you can't be out there at these different races, you can still support and you can still run, and it's still great for you. Just do the virtual option. Almost every race nowadays, especially in the Suffolk County Veteran Run Series, has a virtual option. So don't be afraid that you're, I have a barbecue that Saturday, or I work that Saturday, or my daughter's home, or whatever the case may be. Don't worry about it. Okay? You have a virtual option. You can do it. And the next race that's coming up is going to be the Project Nine Line Heart of an Eagle, Team RWB 5K. Great race. It's out at Hexter State Park. This one I will be at. My buddy Rob Novotny runs this one, and I love supporting it. It is a beautiful run out by the water. When it's windy, skinny asses like myself get blown around a little bit, but normal-sized human beings, you'll be fine. But it's a great race. It's a beautiful race. September 10th, 8 o'clock, Hexter State Park here on Long Island. Virtual option available. Again, if you're not from here or if you just can't make it that day, please check out the virtual option. All the money goes to Team RWB, Project Nine Line, two great organizations here on Long Island doing great things for veterans. So please check that out. Go to the Suffolk County Veteran Run Series website and just click on Heart of an Eagle. That is the next one coming up. We are training for the marathon. I've been posting on Instagram and all of that, some of the runs I've been doing, getting ready for the marathon. We're hoping to have some people on that are going to talk about running marathons, training for marathons, and all that. We'll probably be doing that in September. So I hope that's some good information as we lead into the end of October. I believe it's October 23rd, Suffolk County Marathon. I will be out there running the bridge. I can't wait. I'm feeling great. I'm feeling really good. The heart rate's perfect. Everything is right where it belongs. My feet feel good. I just switched up my shoes. I went to a different brand. I was getting some rubbing and some blisters on one of my left foot, and I switched up my shoe. And I'm good to go. So I'm back in it, and everything is great. So please, let's get ready for that. October 23rd is the Suffolk County Marathon. Still plenty of time to sign up. There's even virtual options for that. So no excuses. Different lengths. They got a 5K. They got a half marathon. Trust me, there's plenty to do. Get over to the website. Check it out. Please be a part of this. Support these organizations that are trying to help veterans. I want to get back into our veteran-owned and operated business of the week. This week, we have a great one for you, especially since we're talking about running and these races and things like that. We have Thigh Huggers. If you have not checked these guys out, get on their Instagram page. It's awesome. Okay, people post the craziest stuff wearing these shorts. They are short, short, short shorts, and I love them. Ranger panties to the end. I wore the America Fuck Yeah shorts for the DFQ duathlon, the 22-mile we did with Project Nine Line, and no chafing. I was really surprised because I thought as short as they were, you were going to get some chafing. No chafing. But let me tell you, they have some of the coolest designs. If you ever wanted to be the talk of a party or a race or a run, or if you have a corporate event, they can even print special ones for you. Very, very cool. Very unique stuff. They even have short denim shorts. They even have the Rocky Four. It was the American flag Rocky shorts. They have so many different types, but you can head over to thighhuggers.com. Check them out. They usually range at about $25 to $30. Make sure you look at the sizing chart because it is very, you want to get this right because you don't want a short short to be a long short. Or way too short and you'd be showing something you didn't know you were going to be showing. So check out their sizing chart. They also on the Instagram, which is really cool, they actually put up models and they put their height and weight and all of that. So you can kind of try to, and that's what I did because I'm a weird shape and I matched up kind of as close as I could to a height and weight and boom, they fit perfect. Okay, so you can go on the Instagram, see different models wearing the shorts and their height and weight and what size they ordered and boom, that really helps you out. So that's a really cool thing that they did. And again, you should be following these guys on Instagram because I love their Instagram account. It's a lot of fun. They have some of the coolest designs out there. They have a pot of gold. They have surfing bears. They got pineapples. They got straight up plaid if you're into that. Like I said, the America Fuck Yeah is my favorite. I got that. That they got the giant freedom eagle. But they also have shirts. All right. They have the Thigh Club shirts, men's shirts. They have hoodies. They also have swag and all that kind of stuff. You can become an ambassador for them. Just head over to the website and check out what they got. Their kind of luau shirts are awesome. So, remember, it's always important to wear a Hawaiian shirt on a Hawaiian shirt day. So please get over here and you can get one of the best ones you'll ever see at some of these designs, whether it's Come and Take Them or the, Banana Mag or, the chickens with snorkels and tactical duckies, all sorts of stuff. Like I said, please just head over. I can't tell you every single one. Get over to the website, thighhuggers.com. They're our veteran-owned and operated business of the week. I think that's almost about it. As always, like us on Instagram, Facebook, check out the YouTube page. Please get over to the podcast providers and give a little review. Leave a 5-star if you would. Send show ideas to bulletproofveteran@gmail.com. Reach out the website to listen to past episodes at bulletproofveteran.com. And I'm always throwing stuff up on there for cool stuff, especially as we get closer to the holidays. I'll probably do some more recipes and drinks and all that kind of stuff will be up there as well. And if we ever do any kind of events, everything will be up on the website. What am I forgetting? Oh, Amazon. Head over to Amazon, check out some of our shirts and phone cases and all hoodies, jackets, all that stuff is up there. We have the new logo design. We have the old logo design. We have some of our just fun stuff. We still have the Fuck Heart Disease shirts. We got the Pogue shirt. We got a Humvee grill. Rock, paper, scissors. Well, what is it? Rock or something, paper, scissors shirt is a really cool one if you enjoy making fun of MREs. The jalapeno cheese spread one, another MRE-inspired shirt. Again, check that stuff out. It's a great way to support the show monetarily. And, you know, all the money goes right back into the show to make it bigger, better, and brighter. So, again, for anybody who has done that in the past, I thank you. And always spreading the word. Best way to support the show. Tell everybody you know. Tell your neighbors, friends that we are here. We keep getting great people to come on the show because more and more people are reaching out. I heard from a friend, blah, blah, blah. I got this guy you should interview. And boom, we have him on the show. So it's a great way. And we spread it and we grow the community. We get you guys the information that you want. So please continue to do that. And I thank everybody that does it every day. I love you guys. All right. I think that's it. All right. It was a great interview. Cole was awesome. Please check out what they're doing over at Mission Roll Call. Sign up and be part of the surveys. Have your voice heard. Okay. And see exactly what they're doing and what they're trying to, you know, get our elected officials to understand about veterans. As less and less veterans are in the community, people don't understand what we need or what we're thinking about. This is a way to change that. So please get over to Mission Roll Call, sign up, do the surveys, all that stuff. You'll get the text messages, emails, whatever it is. All right. I think that's it. All right. For this week and for Bulletproof Veteran Podcast, my name is Jason, and thank you for your service.